The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So for tonight, I wanted to talk a bit about the concept of dharma. And a little bit I'm inspired by having just been on retreat for the last 10 days, teaching retreat in Vajrapani. And there's a lot of dharma on retreat. And so the dharma. The dharma is a very important concept in Buddhism. It's perhaps one of the most important things to see, to understand, to realize in practice. It's said that of the three jewels of Buddhism, the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, even the Buddha had to rely on the Dharma. And when he first was practicing, there was no Buddha and no Sangha. But even the Buddha was dependent on the Dharma, the existence of the Dharma, seeing the Dharma. And sometimes the Dharma is even called the mother of the Buddha because of its great importance. And the great Thai teacher, Buddhadasa, who died about 20 years ago now, he did a lot of interfaith work, explored different religions, much more than most Thai teachers would have done, and did some interfaith dialogues and stuff. And he would say that that God in Buddhism means Dharma. So that's a pretty powerful statement, especially for theists. Maybe not for Buddhists who don't know what God is. But it's a powerful statement. And so I'm trying to point to you how central this is. When monastics chant in the morning, in the evening, they'll chant praise to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And I wanted to read to you the praise that's done, or the remembrance that's done. It's actually called a remembrance, not a praise, of the Dharma. And then I thought I would say a little bit more about the Dharma and then talk about these. I thought I would try chanting it to you. And it says that the English goes, the Dharma is well expounded by the Blessed One, apparent here and now, timeless, encouraging investigation, leading to liberation, to experience individually by the wise. So it doesn't, it doesn't read that nice in English. But in Pali, in monasteries, they chant this several times a day, twice a day, over and over again. And kind of, when you chant something in a kind of church Latin, it kind of has a certain kind of charisma and power in people's hearts. Svakato bhagavata dhammo sanditiko akaliko ehipasiko upanayiko pachatam veditabo vinuiti. Something like that. Those of you who have learned the chant know that it's a little bit off. But sanditiko, that's many people remember that, know the chant that really sticks. Sanditiko, it means apparent here and now. And then akaliko means timeless. Eipasiko means inviting inspection, inviting investigation, inviting you, come here, take a look. Upanayiko means leading onwards. In this translation, they explain it, leading onwards to liberation. And then known by the wise, known directly, individually by the wise. And people can have tremendous reverence for the Dharma and for this chant. And in the Abhayagiri chant book, they go on after doing this, and they say this. I won't do it in Pali, but in English. So after chanting these qualities of the Dharma, they say, now let us chant the supreme praise of the Dharma. It is excellent because it is well expounded, and it can be divided into path and fruit, practice and liberation. The Dharma holds those who uphold it from falling into delusion. I revere the excellent teaching, that which removes darkness, the Dharma which is the supreme secure refuge for all beings. As a second object of recollection, I venerate it with bowed head. I am indeed the Dharma's servant. The Dharma is my Lord and guide. The Dharma is sorrow's destroyer, and it bestows blessings on me. To that teaching I dedicate this body and life, and in devotion I will walk this excellent way of truth. For me there is no other refuge. The truth is my excellent refuge. By the utterance of this truth may I grow in the Master's way. By my devotion to the truth and the blessings of this practice, by its power may all obstacles be overcome. By body, speech, and mind, for whatever wrong action I have committed toward the truth, may my acknowledgement of fault be accepted, that in future there may be restraint regarding the Dharma. So this is chanted. In the local monastery in Abhayagiri, they chant it in Pali, and then after that they chant in English. Beautiful kind of Gregorian chanting. And some of you might know it. You know it? Beautiful. When they do it in their chanting style. And some people are inspired, it's very moving to chant this and to reflect on the Dharma. And some people, I imagine some of you, say, uh-oh, what did I do coming here today? All this religious stuff, and now we've talked about God and Dharma and reverence and bowing your head and confessing, your faults. And, this is getting a little bit too heavy here. So patience as we get into it here. Another place where the Dharma is really given a very powerful place in Buddha's teachings is soon before he died. He made this statement. Sometimes before people die, and he knew he was dying. So they usually say more significant things. People do. So he said, be islands unto yourself. Be refuges for yourself. Take no other refuge. Let the Dharma be your island. Let the Dharma be your refuge. Take no other refuge. So first it says take yourself as a refuge, as an island. Here the island is considered to be the island from the floods of things that cause suffering. So make an island that's safe, make a refuge of yourself, and make no other refuge. And then immediately it says make something else a refuge. It says make the Dharma your refuge, make the Dharma your island, make no other refuge. The only way to reconcile this is that the self and Dharma are the same. And so because of this famous quote, in Theravadan Buddhism we have, sometimes we say that there are four refuges. Classically in Buddhism, there's three refuges or treasures that are venerated. The Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Sangha meaning the community of practitioners, especially those practitioners who have kind of verified for themselves the truth of all this. And in some schools of Buddhism, like in Tibetan Buddhism, they have a fourth refuge, which is considered to be the guru. Very important role in Tibetan Buddhism. In Theravadan Buddhism, kind of almost like the opposite, the fourth refuge is yourself. And to what degree, how do you find yourself as a refuge? How are you a refuge for yourself? How are you the Dharma is the question. So here we've been venerating the Dharma as if this external thing, when you're associated with God, it's something external for most people. If you're associated with something you bow your head down towards and venerate, then it's something kind of external, something you bow to and put up your hands. But here, it's turned around and says the Dharma is you. But they can't possibly mean you, of course. You know, because maybe you, but not me. You know, impatient with my kids and, you know, this and that, you know. It's all kinds of things that, funny things go on in here. It can't be me. I'd rather put my eggs in the basket of something else. I don't see anything as good here. But luckily there's a lifesaver out there, the Buddhism. You know, Buddhism. And if I can just kind of yoke myself to this great world religion, and then probably I'll be safe. I'll get myself, you know, Buddhist costume, uniform, and people know that I'm a Buddhist, and I'll be really, things will be all okay. Maybe I'll chant if I bow a lot. But you can't get away from it because in our tradition, you're the refuge. So the question is, how do you make yourself a refuge? How do you find yourself as the refuge? And so there's a few places in the ancient discourses of the Buddha where someone asked the Buddha about this word that the Dharma is apparent or visible here and now. Remember in this chant I said the sanditiko describes Dharma, something which is visible here and now. What that suggests is that it's not mystical. And it's not something that you can't see. You know, most concepts of God is some, you know, like, you know, you can't really see God. It's something transcendent, something other. It's so great. And some people have understandings of kind of mystical understandings of reality, of spirituality, that there's some transcendent realm that you can't really see, but you can sometimes intuit it or sometimes have some altered experience. And here, the Buddha describes the Dharma as visible here and now. The expression here and now, here, is, you know, apparent, something that's easy. It's, you know, not ordinary exactly, but something visible through the ordinary eyes that we have, not through some special, highly trained, deeply realized eyes of, you know, full enlightenment or something. So this wanderer, at the time of the Buddha, went to the Buddha and exchanged courteous greetings with him. After an exchange of friendly greetings and courtesies, he sat to one side. As he was sitting there, he said to the Blessed One, to the Buddha, "The Dharma is visible here and now. The Dharma is visible here and now. It is said. To what extent is the Dharma visible here and now? Timeless, inviting inspection." Here it's translated as pertinent, and to be realized by the wise for themselves. "Very well, then. I will ask you a question in return." One of the remarkable things about the Buddha was often when people asked him something, many times he wouldn't give them a direct answer, but would ask them a question in return as a way of leading them, almost leading them to understand for themselves, to realize from the inside out rather than just telling them the answer. And this is a very important principle. "Answer as you see fit. What do you think? When greed is present within you, do you discern that greed is present within me? And when greed is not present within you, do you discern that greed is not present within me?" "Yes," said the wanderer. "The fact that when greed is present within you, you discern that greed is present within you, and when greed is not present within you, you discern that greed is not present within you, that is one way in which the Dharma is visible in the here and now, timeless, inviting verification, pertinent, to be realized by the wise for themselves." You get that? When you really see the presence and absence of greed, you see the presence of the Dharma. How many of you are disappointed? Just regular old ordinary garden variety greed? Then the Buddha went on, "What do you think? When aversion is present within you," and then does the same discussion, when it's present, when it's absent, "when delusion is present within you, when So greed, hate, greed, aversion, and delusion. So that's what the Buddha said to him. And then this wanderer said, "Magnificent, magnificent. Just as if he were to place upright what was overturned, to reveal what was hidden, to show the way to one who was lost, or to carry a lamp into the dark so that those with eyes could see forms. In the same way has the Buddha, through many lines of reasoning, made the Dharma clear. I go to the Buddha for refuge. I go for refuge in the Dharma and to the community. May the Buddha remember me as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge from this day forward for life." So he came and asked the Buddha a question, asking, how is it the Dharma is visible here and now? How is it that it's timeless? How is it that it's onward leading? How is it that it's, inviting inspection? And how is it that it's known by the wise directly? And then the Buddha gives what I take to be a very direct, matter-of-fact, ordinary answer. Or ordinary in the sense that I think we can all see, it's something we can all see in ourselves. We can see, hopefully we can see, when we're caught up in greed, lust, craving. And we can see when we're not. And if you can see those two things, you've seen the Dharma. We can see when we're caught in the grip of hate, of aversion, of hostility, of ill will. And we can see when we're not. And we can see, maybe it's harder, this one's maybe harder for some people, but we supposedly at some point we can see the presence of delusion and the absence of it. So that's the Dharma. So where is the Dharma found? It's found in yourself. There's no other place to find it. It's not like this external thing. It's not like this great teaching or this reality that's kind of distinct and separate from you. The Dharma is found in you when you can see these things directly. Now, why is this significant? Why is this kind of Dharma, this kind of understanding, the seeing, considered to be so ultimate and so amazingly meaningful in Buddhism that it's honored and worshipped, people bow down to it? People offer flowers, they offer incense, they dedicate their life to it. That's the question. And what do you think? I'm asking you.
This is enough. And as long as this is enough, what more do you need?
So how does that insight into the presence and absence of greed bring you to this?
So greed is when this is not enough and you want something else. But if this is all there is, then this is it. So delusion is wanting more than's right here.
Uh-huh. But right here I'm suffering, so how can that be enough?
It's interesting, sometimes your suffering is really a good friend, and it's very hard to see that sometimes.
Mm-hmm. How is it a good friend?
It shows you variations on delusion. Suffering. You watch it carefully.
Uh-huh. Suffering is one way to encounter the Dharma. So if you see your suffering well, you'll see the presence of greed or the absence of it, the presence of hate or the absence of it, the presence of illusion or the absence of it. If you can look at your suffering and see those two things and see the absence of it, then you found the Dharma and you found your freedom from it. Thank you.
So you mean that it's not real then?
What's not real? Buddhism doesn't get very much interested in whether things are real or not real, because the question of whether things are real or not real don't really say much about the inner process of clinging. of grasping. And so, and in fact, what the Buddha tended to say is the whole question of real and not real is a little bit of a diversion from taking responsibility in ourselves for how we, our own minds work. And it's the Dharma has a lot to do with how our minds work, understanding that in some deep way. And so certainly we can see things that are not real. We can just assume that things are there. But is greed real or not real? Is a lap real? You're sitting there in a chair. Is your lap real? When you stand up, what happens to it? Oh, thoughts aren't real?
Sorry?
Thoughts aren't real?
Well, perhaps not.
It's made up.
We make it up.
It's made up. Oh, they're made up.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. So if the word is greed made up, I suppose it's kind of made up, but that doesn't make it less real. It's whatever the world is, whether it's made up or real or not real, it's the inner world of clinging, which leads to suffering. So that you can ask almost the same question, is suffering real or not real? And again, Buddhism doesn't answer that question because it's not interesting. It's what's important. What's important is, are you suffering? And you know a path to become free of suffering.
I guess my point was, if you believe that it's real, then you suffer. If you believe that it's not real, you wouldn't suffer. If you knew, you were just making it up. I mean, if you could see the difference,
oh, yeah.
You know?
I think so. Yeah, so that's where you see the Dharma. If you can see where the inner mental process, the inner psychological process operating, and see not only the existence of something, the presence of something, but also the freedom from it, right. Then there's liberation there. So, for example, if I see the arising of my lust for something, if I'm very present and mindful, I could see right there that I don't have to pick it up. I can leave it alone. I don't have to get involved in that. And then when I leave it alone, what have I saved myself from? Maybe someone else. What have I saved myself? Oh, Richard.
You? I don't know if I'm going to answer your question.
Really? But you know something about lust.
Yes, I do.
Significant amount. I think I wrote somebody an email today saying that I'm 99.9% in Sakyaditi. So I'd say I know a lot about lust. But the example that you gave initially was the Buddha saying, if you see greed, or if you see delusion or hatred or aversion. Who sees that? That's my question.
Okay, so that's also not an interesting question.
Because, only from the standpoint, let me finish. If you're able to see the greed, then essentially you've teased apart something that you don't have to, you can let go of, you can recognize that it isn't, the greed isn't necessarily you.
Right.
Okay.
That helps.
I'm not greed. Yeah, I'm noticing the greed.
What is you?
I'm observing the greed.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a conditioned being, culturally conditioned being, essentially. And I'm the awareness that maybe the field of awareness, the consciousness, this experience that I can rest in, can observe greed, can observe hatred and delusion. And working with that awareness, working with that practice, I might free myself of certain ways of interacting, behaving, working with the lust, working with the aversion,
so
and so forth.
I asked before then is, When you see lust, for example, arise in the mind, and you don't pick it up, you leave it alone and let it just dissipate, what have you avoided besides the lust itself? What?
Suffering.
Suffering? But that's kind of a vague word. We use it too much around here. So try again. No?
No.
Avoid getting caught?
If you don't pick it up, you don't identify with it.
You don't identify it. You don't have to define yourself by it, for example.
Right. Yeah.
But there is part of it that remains, I do think. I do.
What part that remains?
It's like a memory of it. It's the memory of how it used to catch you. And there is an awakening, I think, in a part of me that a memory of still wanting it.
Oh yeah, if you really take in and let it really register that you've been burned by someone, you're probably more cautious to, you know, to go and buy snake oil from them again.
And so for me, when I see it and I consciously let it go, it takes energy. It takes a concentration and a focus.
To do that, to let go, to be
yes,
able to...
Yes, so that it's not a complacent thing at all.
Uh-huh, okay, great. So what other things are avoided by not picking up the lust? So not getting caught, suffering was one thing you said. Why is it so significant? Yes?
Hurting someone.
Hurting someone. So, because it's easy to hurt someone if we're operating out of our lust. What else?
Being choiceless.
Being choiceless. So say a little bit more.
Well, if you're forced to attune every time you see lust appear,
yeah,
then you don't have any choices.
Ah. So if you pick it up, your lust, then you've lost your freedom.
Yes.
And some people have lost it big time. You know, they don't realize it because, you know, especially if you have an avenue to fulfill your lust, I'm free. I like being free. You know, I get to act on my desires. Sometimes you only get to see clearly how much compulsion there is in the mind and how we're slave to compulsion when something can't be fulfilled. What else? Yes. So you avoid losing trust in yourself?
Trust in myself and a measure of self-esteem and self-respect.
Uh-huh.
And there's a separation from my goodness.
Uh-huh.
In attaching myself to an outside pleasure that I believe is not healthy for me in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And separating... That way it kind of separates from my feelings of being good in my goodness, which to me is a separation from
uh-huh.
God.
Great.
So it's sort of bringing me down into a lower self that then I find really difficult to not judge and not beat myself up over. And similarly, I've kind of suck somebody else into that place by either being pursuing them or, you know, saying here.
Uh-huh.
So I'm sort of it's a co-conspiracy into a lower place.
Uh-huh. Great.
Yeah.
Thank you. I saw one more hand over here.
It sort of deals with issues of materialism almost and. Conditioning yourself to believe that you'll constantly get what you want if you continually submit to urges to pick something up or take something, and subsequently makes it that much more difficult to deal with situations where you're not given a choice or where things are not going to work out the way you want them to necessarily.
So it reinforces a habit, and an habit and the expectation of having being an agent who can control things. And
the very self-centered habit and expectation. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Thank you.
I confess, I need you, Gil, to clarify the idea of dharma that's not inside the self, but is other than the self or outside, just ordinary outside reality.
So that's a good question.
I haven't heard you say it before.
Did I say it today?
Well, it sounded that way, so perhaps I'm just confused. So could you clarify?
No.
I mean, you said that dharma was kind of like what you do inside your head, and for me, dharma is probably what isn't myself a lot, and that would be outside. So
is it? Is it? I don't need the mic. This whole issue of self, outside of self, not self is a whole interesting question about all this. And Richard brought up a question earlier about the self here. What's interesting about the self is not what is or is not the self, but rather what's interesting is the process by which we perceive a self, the process by which we identify and create a sense of self. And when we can see clearly that process, we can hopefully see, is there something like clinging, great craving, ill will, aversion, delusion in that process of self-creating? And if you could see the presence and absence of these three poisons, then hopefully we can leave it alone and have whatever the self is be something that doesn't, not associated with greed, hate, and delusion, not perceived or not created or constructed with that. And in fact, the whole idea of, and as time goes along, I say it this way, what Buddhism points at as being the key issue about coming free of suffering is understanding the psychological processes within us that contribute to create that suffering. And that's where dharma is found, is in those psychological processes. Now, this goes against the grain for certain theistic religions, where what's considered most sacred is something that's external to you that you have a relationship to. And it's very hard sometimes for theistic people to understand how Buddhism can be even a religion, because they don't have the same relationship to seemingly to something external, a god or ultimate reality or something like that. And so I know I'm not answering your question yet, but I'm hopefully getting there. And but then, if you pay attention to the sense of self and see how it's constructed and how we make it and how it interferes with many things in our lives, how often this constructed, perceived sense of self, identification, representation, is not really a full representation of actually what is. And it doesn't really represent all of what functions in our lives and how it's a very limited scope. Then people sometimes want to say, well, there's some other grace operating here. There's something else beyond my self-concept. But what is that? And Buddhism doesn't actually answer a lot of questions about the ultimate nature of a self, the ultimate nature of reality, the ultimate nature of what's real and not real. Buddhism is relatively limited in scope. And what it's limited to is it's limited to to really understanding well the processes within ourselves of what we do, of the beliefs we hold on to, the attachments we have, so that we can let go of them and not, in our psychological processing, create more suffering for ourselves, to be liberated ourselves from suffering. And once we're free from suffering, the question of whether there is a self or not a self, if there is a reality outside of us or not, if it's, are the real or not real things, maybe it's an interesting class to take a philosophy course with about, it has this value to look at those things. But it's a whole different perspective because we've satisfied, we've met and dealt with the psychological need or the inner need to free ourselves from suffering or causing suffering in the world around us. Now, more directly in answering to your question, I loved a quote. I think it was by Max Faraday, the person who came up with some of the laws of thermodynamics. He said once, someone asked him, "Where do you get your ideas? Where do you get your discoveries, your equations, and all that?" And he said, "It was something inside of me which is not myself." So in other words, you know, he didn't take ownership from it, responsibility for it, you know, like my egotistical sense of self, what identifies myself. But also, he couldn't attribute it to something outside either. It was this deep process, some other, you know, fuller processing of the mind, of the heart or something. So what I've tried to say today is that the Dharma is considered very important for Buddhists. But where the Dharma is found in ourselves, in a sense, not externally. You don't find the Dharma in a book. You don't find the Dharma by coming to IMC by itself. You don't. You know, if you're looking around IMC for it, you won't find it. You have to find it in yourself. And it's found in yourself by this, what seemingly is very simple, and is deceptively kind of simplistic, and in terminology that some people will actually kind of be dismissive of it. How could this be ultimate and important? How could this focus on self be so valuable and so important? Are these Buddhists selfish, self-centered? Simply greed, hate, and delusion can't, the absence of greed, hate, and delusion, that can't be that significant compared to a lot of the great, wonderful things you can do in life. But for Buddhists, that actually is very significant. And as we practice mindfulness and get more sensitive to how the movements of clinging and aversion operate, we become aware of what a deep, pervasive foundation it provides for much of the functioning of our life. In fact, much of the self-concept, much of the way which we perceive ourselves, is rooted in some form of clinging, greed, aversion, delusion. And so if we can get still enough so we can see deeply, so we can have very strong powers of mindfulness, we have the ability to begin understanding more and more deeply how these three things, these three poisons, operate in our hearts and mind. And more powerfully, we see there's an alternative to living with them. It's possible to live without these three things operating. And to see both, see the presence of greed, hate, and delusion, and see the possibility, or see the absence of it, that's where the Dharma is found. And when you find the Dharma there, then it leaves you with choice. Which fork do you take? Do you follow the fork of greed, hate, and delusion, clinging? Or do you follow that of freedom from clinging? Initially, for many people, there's a strong gravitational pull into the world of clinging, grasping, attachment, greed, hate, delusion. And you see it, you know, very dramatically in people who are addicts. But, you know, in Buddhism, if you go on a meditation retreat like I just been on, pretty quickly you have to conclude that you're probably addicted to your thinking. You know, hi, I'm Gil, and I'm a thinker. And the gravitational force is really strong in the direction of being pulled into what we want, into our desires, our fears, our expectations, our plannings, our memories, and the strength of our preoccupations, the strength of where the mind wants to go and latch onto, the strength of our unresolved issues that come up in our mind, are all fueled by some form of clinging, of attachment. And it, by definition, because if you can't put it down, you're attached to it. You're stuck to it. If you can put it down, say, well, I don't need that, I'll put it, then you're not attached. And you can see it very clearly on retreat, in meditation, where you try to let go of your thoughts, let go of some concern, and it comes right back up. Or maybe doesn't even go to begin with. So initially, the gravitational force is really strong, pulling us into the world of clinging. And so it takes a lot of strength, inner strength and discipline, to develop the inner mindfulness and inner strength to begin changing the gravitational force, to not give in to greed, hate, and delusion, to choose the opposite. Eventually, what happens with practice is that at some point you reach kind of a tipping point, and the gravitational force of non-clinging becomes stronger than the gravitational force of clinging. And so then the mind inclines itself or desires to move towards non-clinging. So in this chant that earlier, the Dharma is apparent here and now in the functioning, the processes of our own mind. That's where we find it. It is timeless because a movement from clinging to lack of clinging doesn't require any time when we've gotten good at it. And it puts us into a kind of a space, a perception or a place that is more timeless than of time. The mental space or the heart space of not clinging is not something that belongs to time. And if you really, if the experience of non-clinging is very, very powerful, it really feels like a timeless experience. And then it's a very interesting expression that it invites investigation. The Dharma invites investigation. And my sense is that if you're mindful enough, quiet enough, you'll see that the mind has a natural, there's almost like a curiosity or an interest to look and understand what we're doing. What are the processes of suffering that operate within us, process of clinging and unclinging? And there's an invitation to come look more carefully. And so this inviting inspection, inviting investigation, is sometimes interpreted in Buddhism to mean that you're invited. There's no obligation to practice in Buddhism. There's no cosmic obligation. There's no great reality outside of us, a God outside of us who obligates us, thou shalt practice Buddhism. Thou shalt be mindful. Your mother might tell you that, but Buddhism doesn't. But Buddhism invites you. There's a kind of invite, come and look more carefully. Look at this. And they're not inviting you to look at, you know, Buddhism itself. They're inviting you to look at yourself. Look more deeply. That's where the Dharma is. And then it's verifiable by the wise. So if you become wise enough to see how this operates, you can verify the truth of the Dharma. You can verify the peace, the freedom that comes when we don't cling. The process of getting from one gravitational pull to the other, from the gravitational pull of clinging to non-clinging, is a very, you want to use the word, fascinating process. It's a very challenging process that requires a tremendous amount of self-learning, understanding about oneself. It also requires, or in addition, it requires that we begin questioning, a lot of questioning, about some of the things that we believe will make us happy. Because, and the way questioning can happen very simply, and that is, if you have some inkling of an idea that in some situation it's possible for you not to cling, but you don't want to stop, but you're not willing to give up the clinging, then you can ask yourself, what do you think is more valuable and more important than non-clinging? Why is clinging more important than not clinging? What are you willing to sacrifice your peace for? Non-clinging in Buddhism is synonymous with peace. What are you willing to sacrifice your peace for in order to cling to something? So, I mean, it could be as mundane and simple as finding the Dharma on the freeway on 101 at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Sitting there in traffic, you're not going anywhere. Gridlock. Nothing's happening. You're peaceful. It's nice. Or you can imagine that, maybe. But then you feel constricted and tight. Do you feel that beginning of constriction and tightness. Why? The question is why? Why are you picking up constriction and tightness? Why are you getting involved in that? I don't have a choice. This is the nature of the universe. That when you're stuck on traffic, late for home, you get tense. You don't, that belief obscures the Dharma. If you want to find the Dharma, you don't live in those kind of beliefs. You question them. And you ask, what is it that I'm doing now that leads to this tension, this constriction? What are the choices I've made? In particular, what have I chosen as being more important than being peaceful? And it might be it's more important to worry about the person who's going to be angry with you because you're late for the appointment. There's a choice made. It's really important to worry. Now, many people don't think they see the choice. That's not a choice. But if you can see the Dharma, you see the choice. And then you can question, is it really worth my time to worry about what the person's going to think about me? Because my worrying is not going to help. The car in front of me is not moving. I think I can just let go, and I'll deal with the person when I come. So I don't know if that was a good example, but I was trying to point to a very simple, ordinary example of finding the Dharma, or trying to find the Dharma, in a way that hopefully encourages you to question yourself, and to question, what is it that you believe? What do you believe is important enough that you're willing to cling? And unless you start questioning that and doubting the beliefs that you live by that tell you consciously or unconsciously that it's important to cling, you won't find the Dharma. And as you get good at this, as you get more and more mindful and insightful and really see this deeply, this inner Dharma that we're talking about, it becomes a refuge. It becomes a place of safety. It becomes an island. It becomes a place of, all these things of beautiful kind of description of the Dharma from these chants that were so lofty are all found in yourself. And it becomes, and you go through life safe from what? Safe from yourself. And the ultimate safety that Buddhism can offer you is really that safety from yourself. And those of you who are already safe that way, you can don't have to come here. And those of you who can do with a little bit more safety from your clinging and your fear and your aversion and your delusion and things like that, then the Dharma is inviting you to look more closely. So that's my discussion about the Dharma. I hope it made some sense. And I wish that the Dharma supports you for a long time. Thank you.